Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And we're going to talk about something very important today, a journey that we all take at some point in our lives. And many of us have experienced other people taking this journey. And the journey is through the last moments of life. And it could be a longer time, a month or two, or a day or two, or a minute or two. And things happen that are different, that our experiences demonstrate another reality. Of course, dying is, but the journey to it and what we experience and see from those who are dying is very educational for us and helpful to understand the process and where we go, perhaps. So to do that, there's this wonderful book. It's very important to read this book. I loved it. Words at the Threshold. What is it that dying people say and act, actually, behave at the threshold, the last moment of their lives? What do they communicate and how? So to help us understand all this is the author of Words at the Threshold, Lisa Smart. Lisa, welcome to Energy Stew. Hello. Okay. Okay. Lisa, welcome to Energy Stew.
Great. Hello. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I'm so glad to talk with you. This is a very important book, and I've certainly experienced the death of many people and have had some experiences that you talk about in your book. And it's quite an undertaking to, a work of life to understand what the dying have to say.
You are so right. 5 years ago, I just, when I saw my father dying and I saw the shifts in his language, I became possessed with curiosity. And I, for the last 5 years, I've been on this journey to understand final words, and it, I feel like I've only just begun, even though there are definitely patterns that have emerged through the research.
And you're not the only pioneer in this. There has been an ample amount of research about collection of stories about the words that dying people have to say.
You know, you're absolutely right, and I'm not a pioneer in that way. And I think one of the things that really surprised me, my training is in linguistics, so I've learned to study, obviously, language and patterns of language. And so there has been a lot of research, but there have been few places that have been able to pull it all together through the lens of language. But when I looked at the research that was there, much of it was not specifically linguistic or called linguistic, but they're remarkable stories about what people say in their last days. And we hear.
And I really love the way that you approach this in your book, because you start off talking about nonsense. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that kind of took me aback. Wait a minute, you know. Are these people speaking nonsense in the way I understand that word? But you brought a new, deeper understanding of that.
Yeah, my understanding of nonsense was actually informed by Dr. Raymond Moody, who coined the term near-death experience in 1975. And Raymond has spent 40 years of his life researching unintelligible language. And I had the great great fortune of being able to work with him on this Final Words project. And he really talks about, you know, there's almost a nonsense taboo. Many of us, of course, if we hear someone we love start speaking in language we don't understand, it can be scary and it can be puzzling to us. But what we know and what Raymond has researched and he and I have researched together now is that nonsense is as much a part of the human vocabulary and experience as sensical language is. So, for example, you know, we love Dr. Seuss. I mean, Dr. Seuss, who doesn't love Dr. Seuss, right? And yet he is really, if you look at the language, complete nonsense. We look at Alice in Wonderland is nonsense. So really, it's as much a part of the human experience to speak nonsensically as it is to speak sensically. Yet, when we hear nonsensical language, especially at a time when we're grieving and someone we love is leaving us, it can be really frightening. And yet, there are indications to me that when we see nonsense in people's language, it may indicate some kind of shift in consciousness and at least tapping nonverbal consciousness, if nothing else.
So there might be a deeper sense to nonsense.
That, absolutely.
That bridges the different worlds that dying people are in.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the examples that was most powerful to me in my research is we know that people who have near-death experiences come back with this very paradoxical language that almost sounds like Alice in Wonderland. So, for example, someone may say who died and then can't come back, they may say, wow, I never felt as alive as when I was dead, because they had these amazing experiences. And that's paradox, right? Technically, that's nonsense. Or one of the most classic research that's been done is with Kenneth Ring and Sharon Cooper. They looked at the near-death experiences of the blind. And these were people, most of them, who were born, you know, were born blind. And they came back during their near-death experiences. They came back and said that they were able to see during their out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences. And they said things like, well, even though I'm blind, I was able to see. So again, that's a paradoxical and technically nonsensical sentence. And we hear from what the dying say, we hear all kinds of things that we would consider nonsense, such as, I'm going up so I can go down. Yes, I would like some scrambled eggs, but where would you reappear? And we hear just a whole variety of nonsensical phrases, as well as metaphoric ones. And some can make more sense to us, and others are just completely baffling. But it might be indication that there's something much greater going on.
Well, I think there is something much greater going on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And some of that is understandable, not just from their language, but their visions. And I think that's even just as fascinating, is what the dying are able to see, because they're really in a transcendent state. They, you know, it's, we don't understand that. We think that they're losing it more and more and more and more till there's nothing left, and that's the end.
Yeah.
And what we're learning from this is that, yes, they're losing the normal literate structure that we've learned in this life. But what they're moving into is a world of that's more, let's call it, you know, telepathic, that's more visionary. And I do believe that life on the other side isn't as linear and literal as life here. We make it so with our minds, but we communicate, you know, in magical ways.
Absolutely.
And so it's fascinating to have experiences of people dying and watch them actually come alive as they die to move into another time. And then they're gone, and, you know, but they're, how many times are they uplifted as they die instead of you know, downtrodden as they die?
Oh, yes. So, yes, what you say has been so much my experience. Excuse me. And when I started this research, I was someone who was very afraid of dying, and I had not been associated at all with you know, death and dying in any way, although I had read Raymond's book when I was 17, you know, Life After Life and so forth. But when my father, who was an absolute skeptic and rationalist, began to speak about angels in his last 3 weeks of life, I mean, this was a man who would roll his eyes at the word of angel, right, or anything cross-dimensional. And not only did he speak of visions of angels, and 3 days before he died, he announced that the angels had told him that he had 3 days left, and indeed that's what occurred. But also there was this very sacred feeling in the room. And so he was talking in metaphors about things and saying things like, my modality is broken, you know, and I felt I was living in another realm, and I had never experienced it before. So for me, there were several things going on. Of course, I was filled with grief because I loved my father deeply, but also the part of me that was a linguist watched what was happening, that there were shifts in language that definitely seemed to track shifts in consciousness that I had not witnessed so clearly and powerfully. And I saw language forms that are not that common in usual language, that are more like dream time. And here was a man, my father, who also was afraid of dying, who believed in nothing beyond this world. And I saw this beautiful sense of surrender in his last few weeks. And he talked about seeing the green dimension and, you know, seeing trees where there are only walls, you know, and through my perception. And once I witnessed my father's experience, that was what set me on this journey to do this final words research, because I thought, oh, my goodness, something is going on with the language here that is tracking something that is happening that I had never understood and known before.
Yes, and so there are so many things in your book about not just this language and vision that people have as they're dying, but also, as you talked about earlier, people who've had near-death experiences and have come back from the other side, or what appears to be the other side. But there are so many similar stories. It's not, you know, it's not some hallucination, because everybody could make up a different kind of hallucination. But there are themes to what happens and where they come back from. And also, as you said, the blind, that's fascinating, that when the blind have near-death experiences that they can actually see. So we don't need eyes out there. We don't need to take our bodies with us so we can see on the other side. Somehow we can see without them.
Absolutely, yeah. I suggest maybe it's not nonsense, but a new sense. And and that's what seems to be revealed in the research. And as you mentioned, people who have near-death experiences, you know, what happened with the near-death experience with Raymond Moody is, as I mentioned, he had an interest and passion in nonsensical language. He has a PhD also in philosophy, and his first dissertation was about Alice in Wonderland and unintelligible language. So when he decided to become a doctor and he was listening to the stories of people who had near-death experiences and were reporting to him, he just started writing them down because he was like, oh, my goodness, these explanations sound like Alice in Wonderland on the, you know, the kinds of paradoxical things I had mentioned before, or something like the blind can see. But he started writing all these things down, and the things that first appeared to be nonsensical fell into patterns, you know, such as there was a tunnel and I walked through it. Well, in isolation, someone talking about a tunnel or a bright light, you know, you might think, what are you talking about? Or, you know, back then people would thought, what are you talking about? That's nonsense, right? But really, when you start looking at patterns of nonsense, something very sensical emerges, right? So that's the same thing with the language of end of life. You know, when I started looking at these transcripts that people shared with me of their beloveds and also of their patients, they started falling into patterns of repetition. You know, repetition is much more common at end of life. Certain types of nonsense, such as people talking about leaving their bodies and moving in space in new and unusual ways. you know, there's suddenly patterns begin to emerge from what seems nonsensical. And that's why both Raymond and I really encourage people to know that language takes many, many forms, and that all of it is part of the human experience.
And sometimes it's just very basic statements. I remember an uncle-in-law years ago, an older man, and his wife had previously died, and he was on his deathbed, and his daughter was sitting by his side, and he was pretty far gone. They were expecting him to die any moment. And all of a sudden, he props himself up in the bed, opens his eyes, and looks at his daughter and says, Mom is in the other room waiting for me. I have to go now.
Oh, wow.
And drops dead on the pillow.
Oh, wow. That gives me tingles. Yeah, that's absolutely. And we hear so many stories of people talking about a loved one waiting for them, you know, having, or some figure with a really loving sense, but generally people that we've known before, you know, showing up at our bedside. And the clarity with which those words were spoken is beautiful in your account and in your story. And we also know that people right before dying have often this kind of window of lucidity where suddenly, even if they were very unresponsive, will come back to say some kind of final word, something like, tell everyone I love them and I'm okay. One woman described how her mother had never told her that she loved her, and she came out of a coma and looked at her and just say, I never said I love you, and I've always loved you. So, you know, one of the things that's interesting to me in those windows of lucidity and when consciousness seems to brighten again, the words are always loving and conciliatory and connective. And to me, that's partly why, you know, I really am convinced that some kind of consciousness continues through the work that I've done here, and that consciousness is so connected to love.
Yeah, it's very important. I've had some experiences with the dying in my family, and my grandfather. Well, my mother, when she was dying, she was in a coma. And the only way that you could get her to respond in the coma was to say, I love you, and then she would grunt. Otherwise, there was absolutely no sign of any recognition of anything. And then her father, when he was dying, and I went to the hospital, he had been in a coma. And I got there, and he came out of the coma because I was there, and he woke up and he was trying to say something, but he could barely get a word out. So I leaned up to put my ear to his mouth, and I said, "Tell me, what do you have to say?" And all he could say was, "I'm a goner," and that was the last he said.
Did he have a sense of humor in his life?
Not really, no, but he was very basic. He was one of these, you know, simple, basic people who didn't have a lot to say, but, you know, this is why he said what he said, was because he was that way.
Absolutely, yes, that's so true. I mean, the words, our final words, so often reflect who we are, and there seems to be not only an essential self that does not have language, right, that the part of us that just goes back to whatever consciousness is as we're dying, we do lose traditional literal language. But at the same time, we do seem to use signature metaphors and signature statements that are connected to our personalities. For example, Jeffrey Holder, who is a dancer and choreographer, as he was dying, turned to his son and said, arms 2, 3, turn 2, 3, swing 2, 3, down 2, 3, and then passed on.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Isn't that beautiful?
Oh, artistic.
And you see so much of that, or I found so much of that in end-of-life language, and there is this sort of paradoxical reality that we are the most essential, the language that emerges and the metaphors are so connected to who we have been as people and who our personalities have been in this lifetime. And at the same time, we also seem to start connecting to something much bigger than who we are as we cross the threshold.
And so I think that's why the fear of death, you know, isn't so real to the people who are dying.
Yeah.
They're not lying there just really being in a negative state. Often they're in a transcendental state.
Yes, that's so true. And my father, again, who is someone so afraid of dying and very intellectual, you know, about things and couldn't think his way out of death, right? None of us can. It makes no sense on one level if we try to make sense of consciousness. And my father couldn't make sense of this world and dying. And however, in his very last days, 2 days before he died, he was talking to his secretary. And he said, "Alice, this is very interesting. I've never done this before." And there's absolutely no fear in that, right? When he spoke, it was almost in a sense of wonder. And when for me to see that from a man who just was so afraid at one time gave me a sense of wonder as I stood at his bedside.
And yeah, it's so important to think that the dying is a journey that is uplifting to the people who are experiencing it, because I think really because they experience another dimension. They experience that the limits of the physical body that we know and are afraid of our physical body just, you know, dying off and we have nothing left, isn't what they start seeing. They start realizing that there's another world. It's a journey to another world. And they have the experience of it, not just a philosophy about it.
Absolutely, yes, that is so true. And, you know, people talk, and one of the hallmarks, and as you mentioned, other researchers have spoken about this as well. One of the hallmarks of end-of-life language is this talking about the journey, talking about in metaphors of travel. And my father, who, again, you know, was a cigar-chomping New Yorker who, you know, loved corned beef and rye and was a very sensual and down-to-earth person, as well as a very intellectual one in some ways, loved to gamble. You know, he was a big gambler. So as he was dying, he started talking about, all right, we got to get the oxygen tank together for my big trip to Las Vegas. You know, and he started talking about this trip to Las Vegas for the big one. And people start talking in, again, the metaphors that are close to them. And, you know, the yellow bus or the trolley, or one person who talked about the Jetta. I have to gas up the Jetta and get ready to go. And so the journey is such a central metaphor that appears in end-of-life language. And people speak of it as if they have their foot in both worlds, because it's something very real to them. One woman who's a chaplain shared with me her story of working with one of the patients who kept talking about how he'd lost his passport and he needed help finding his passport. And she said, you know, that sounds so upsetting. And he said, yes, it is. I just cannot go where I need to. And he said, I'm stuck here between two countries. I'm here, but I want to be there. So that's a very common kind of theme that appears in end-of-life language.
Oh, that's so beautiful. So dying is something we should all look forward to.
You know, I'll tell you, again, for me, this work was so transformational for me, because I am not someone who's, you know, as I said, worked in this field or done any work before. And I have lost, just personally, I have really lost so much fear of dying. And I do have more of a sense that there is an adventure that goes on. And again, I don't want to sugarcoat it because for some people, it's hard to let go of their bodies, especially if there's a lot of fear around them and inside of them. But
right.
part of what's really meaningful to me, or what the message for me in this book is, really to invite people to hold the dying process as something sacred, and to hold the language that they hear as also being sacred. And,
right.
you know, we know that nonsensical language is the language of mystics. You know, a koan, for example, you know, what's the sound of one hand clapping or so forth. If you look at the language of mystics, oftentimes that is language that is not, easily comprehended by literal experience or language.
Right. We can get very deep into metaphor and symbols, and yet, you know, the basic thing here, I think, is just to appreciate the richness of this journey. And I'm not afraid of dying at all. I think it'll be great to get to the other side. I just don't want to leave my family and friends, and I love the work I do. So I'm not ready to go. I almost died a year ago. Well, not quite. 6 months ago, I almost died. Okay. But I'm back, and I'm, you know, just really enjoying, the prospect of the future on this plane. But I know a lot of people who just want to get out of here and aren't happy with their lives, and it's, you know, it's not hard to die. It's just hard to leave. I think we have to really honor that. And even though we know that our loved ones are going to a wonderful place, the beyond, that doesn't mean we won't be in terrible grief to lose them and mourn their passing tremendously. It's nice to know that they're safe and happier, you know, happy, or if they've been in pain, happier on the other side that way. But death is a change that we don't all necessarily want.
Yeah.
We're going to have to sign off, and this is really such a treasure to talk with you, Lisa. Lisa Smart, SMART, two T's. And is there a website?
Finalwordsproject.org.
Finalwordsproject.org. That's great. Lisa, thank you so much for being on Energy Stew. I really love talking with you.
Oh, me too. Thanks so much, Peter.
Sure. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you, and thanks so much for listening.